Let us read again in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 20. Matthew, chapter 20, verse 28. Even as the Son of Man came, not to be ministered unto, but to minister, give his life a ransom for many, many. It has become very common practice in places of work to have regular exchanges of places, meaning that the people at the top of the organisation spend a day at the bottom, and those at the bottom spend some time at the top. And the idea is to try and teach each group the benefits and the disadvantages of the various positions, and so build a stronger organisation. But however many exchanges take place, one that we are unlikely ever to see is the highest in our land becoming the lowest. We are highly unlikely to see, for example, the Queen becoming a servant, the one on the highest throne taking the lowest position, and being not just a servant in a royal household, but perhaps being a servant to the poorest person in the country. But though we are unlikely ever to see that, we can see something even more wonderful, something even more astounding. And that is that the one on the highest throne of heaven came and took the place of the lowest on earth, came to be a servant of sinners. And that is what this verse brings before us here. The Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, not to be served, but to serve, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. There are two things we'd like to look at in this text. First of all, Jesus Christ came to serve sinners. And secondly, Jesus Christ came to pay a ransom for sinners. But first of all, Jesus came to serve sinners. That he came at all is astonishing. Again, if we think of our Queen, she very rarely goes to dangerous, unsafe and unhealthy places in the world. She stays usually in five-star luxury, surrounded by staff, by servants, by security, and rarely comes into contact with any risks, threats, dangers or unpleasantness. But here, this King of all kings, this monarch of all monarchs, came from heaven, the place that is above all the stars, the place which the glory of the stars blinking simply reflect in a measure. He came from that place of ultimate security, that place where he was served by myriads of saints and angels, that place of unimaginable comfort and luxury, joy and happiness. He came from that highest throne to this earth, this place of sin and sinners, this place of lawlessness and disobedience, this place where people dedicate themselves not to the service of the king, but the destruction of the king. Not the coming of the kingdom, but the tearing down of the kingdom. This place that is so full of so many dangers and threats. And how did he come? He didn't come in heavenly glory. He came, as we're told here, as a man, so much so that he took this title, Son of Man. The Son of God became the Son of Man. And he didn't come surrounded by a defensive retinue of staff and of servants and of security. He came on his own as a babe and spent most of his life and ministry on his own. He began it without human help and he ended it without human help. And he came willingly. We come to this earth without any choice in the matter, without any exertion of our own will. We have no say in coming here, but he did. He had a say. He had a choice. And he chose and he willed to come, knowing this world to be as it was, with all its dangers and threats, the Son of Man came. And what did he come to do? Amazingly, even more amazingly, he came not to be served. The one who was worthy of all service, the one whose whole existence had been a lifetime of receiving service, he came not to be served. He came knowing that, at least for a time, he would be without any of these servants and helps as he had known them. At least for a time, instead of him experiencing continual service, he came to give continual service. And the word here is translated in our version as minister. It's the Greek word diakino, from which we get deacon. And it was the word used in the Greek culture of the day for a waiter at tables. And if being a waiter might be in our own day not a work that people would seek out, in these days it was far worse. It was regarded as the most menial and disreputable of jobs. Plato, the philosopher, went so far as to say, how can anyone be happy when he has to serve anyone? And yet this is the word that the Lord uses to describe his role and his work here on earth. He came not to take a position of honour and glory and repute, but he came to take the place of the disreputable and the menial and the despised and the looked down upon, the very lowest service in the very lowest position. And this was not something that had hours in it, 9 to 5 or whatever. It was full time. It was every day. And little thanks he received for it at the time. This is why Jesus came. To serve sinners. Yes, there was a Godward aspect to his service, but there was also a manward aspect. He came to serve God and man. And the emphasis in this verse, as we know from the context, which is discussing positions, the disciples were jockeying, as it were, for positions. So the context would lead us to think that he's speaking specifically of his role in relationship to sinners. If somebody came to you and said to you, "I'm prepared to be your servant. I'll do all your daily chores. I'll do all the work that you least like doing. I'll do all the time-consuming, monotonous, boring tasks that fill so many hours of our days. I'll come and do the menial and the despised tasks." I think almost everyone would jump at the offer. Who would not gladly receive somebody that offered to be our servant in return for no payment? Everyone surely would be glad of it. And so you might think, someone who came into this world to serve on a spiritual level, to do for sinners what they couldn't do for themselves, to do for sinners what was impossible for them ever to do, to come and serve them by suffering for them, to come and serve them by taking away their wrath and their curse, to come and serve them by receiving into his own life and experience all the unpleasantness and anger and wrath that they were due, you would think somebody who came and offered this would have a long queue waiting for his services. Did that happen? Is that happening today? Far from it. Why is that? Why is it that we might be prepared to accept a slave and a servant for every kind of physical task, and yet be stubbornly rejecting any help in spiritual matters? Why is it we can say about these physical, mundane, run-of-the-mill, everyday tasks, take them away and do them? But when it comes to pleasing God, keeping the law, suffering the penalty for sin, we want to keep it somehow or other. We're not prepared to let somebody come and serve us on a spiritual level. Why? It requires humility. It requires us to say, "I can't do that. I can't succeed in that. I can't endure that. I can't do what I'm required to do on a spiritual level. I need someone else to help me." And that takes humility. It takes brokenness for us to admit that we need a spiritual servant. This is why Jesus Christ came, to serve sinners. Are there any sinners here who are willing to let Jesus serve them? Are you hopeless enough? Are you helpless enough? Are you broken enough? Are you convicted enough to finally say, "O King of Kings, be my servant. Do what I cannot do. Take up the responsibilities I cannot fulfill. Perform my duty to God and man in a way I shall never attain to." And that's what a Christian is. A Christian is somebody who says, by their witness, "I need a servant for my soul. And here we have one willing to be that servant, to take on these dishonourable tasks, at least in the eyes of the world. And his greatest service of all is now before us. Not only he came to serve, but he came to serve above all by paying a ransom. The Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. The language of ransom leads us to think of the whole idea of kidnapping. This was the language that was used in these days to describe what was very common, the capturing of somebody and the demanding of a payment in order for the person to be released. It was very common militarily and politically, and even between families. And the practice, of course, still goes on today, especially in certain countries, although we're not so familiar with it ourselves. But it does raise the question, in this situation, who is the kidnapper? Who is the one who has captured? Who is the one who is holding the captive? Who is the one then to whom the ransom is paid? Oftentimes in the history of the church, a mistake has been made here. And the idea has grown that because it's the devil that holds people captive, it's the devil to whom the ransom was paid. But that's to make a huge mistake. The parallel in this illustrative language is not exact with the human situation. You might imagine it's something like this. We've sinned against God, and the penalty is that we are given over into the captivity of sin and Satan. They are the God-ordained punishment for our sins, at least in this world. Sin and Satan are the guards, as it were. They are the ones that have sinners in their grasp. Sin and Satan are these hateful captors of humanity, and they are merciless in holding male and female, young and old, rich and poor, strong and weak. They hold all in their grasp. It is an all-encompassing grasp and imprisonment and captivity. And as we're singing together in Psalm 49, no matter how rich we are, none of us can pay the ransom. None of us can pay the price. Why is that? Well, we read in Psalm 49, as we sang together, none of these, even the exceeding rich, his brother can redeem by any way, nor can he unto God for him sufficient ransom pay. Their soul's redemption precious is, and it can never be. The soul's redemption costs far more than the wealth of the richest in the world, and even of all the richest in the world. Take all the gold and all the diamonds and all the silver, all the pounds and all the dollars and all the currency and all the natural resources in the world. Take it all together, and he says, it's not sufficient. It's not enough. It cannot meet the ransom. Nothing you can do, nothing I can do, Nothing anyone else can do can pay this ransom. And so, does that mean the devil keeps his captives? Does that mean sin retains its deathly grip on the soul? Is there no way of escape? Oh, yes, there is. Because we read here, he came. Who came? The Son of Man came to give his life a ransom for many. You know, you often hear, there was one recently, a young graduate who was held, kidnapped in Colombia. And his parents and his loved ones campaigned for months and months and months to try and secure his release. Because he was precious to them. Because he was worth a lot to them. Many are kidnapped and nobody cares. And they just die. Because they're not worth anything. Or they're not worth enough to some people. Here we read of one who came to campaign for the release of sinners. Because of how much they were worth to him. Is that right? No, it's not right. Because you and I have no worth. We have no value. We can contribute nothing. We have sinned away our value and our worth and our dignity. We're nothings and we're nobodies. And yet, despite our worthlessness, despite our evil deserts, still the Son of Man came to campaign for the release of many captives. And not only to campaign, not only to highlight this predicament, not only to bring pressure to bear to secure the release, but to actually pay the price. And what a price. He came to give his life. What a ransom. We picture in our minds, perhaps on a human level, the ransoms that are paid to release captors and captives in this world. We might picture a big container and the family comes along and they put in £10,000 and the kidnappers say more. They put in another 10,000. They say more. They put in all their money. And they say more. They put in all their rings and their jewels and all their possessions. And the kidnappers say more. And they put in their clothes. They put in everything they have. And the kidnappers say more. What more can they give? They have nothing more to give. And when we think of the ransom here that Jesus Christ paid, what did he give? What did he pour out to release these captives? He poured out his time. He poured out his youth, his adolescence, his 20s, his whole public ministry. And God said more. He poured out his talents and his skills. He poured them all into that ransom. None were expended on any other purposes. Everything was dedicated to this purpose. All his thoughts were poured into this ransom. He never had a selfish thought. Every thought was about the captives. And God said more. He poured all his heart into the ransom. all his feelings, all his affections, all his emotion, and all his love. And God said, more. He poured out all his comforts, all his security. And God said, more. He poured out his reputation. He poured out his friends and his family, losing them all as he went along. And still God said, more. He poured out pains when he was scourged, when he was crowned with thorns, when he was nailed to the tree. And God said, more. He gave his body, his whole body as a ransom. And what did God say? More! What did he need to give? His very soul. That was what he needed to give. That's the word we find here. He gave his soul as a ransom. Who can ever give that? Which human being has ever been able to give their soul for another? But Jesus Christ could. He had not forfeited his soul by sin. His soul was his own. And he gave his soul. He poured it out unto death. And what kind of death was it? It was as if somebody poured damnation into a cup. And as the saying goes, he seized it, and in one tremendous draught of love, he drank damnation dry. He drank it dry. What a price. What a ransom for sin. For sinners. There was a famous American lawyer, Samuel Untermeyer, extremely wealthy. He was a collector of extremely expensive, rare tapestries. And his wife had gone to Europe to find a very rare example of this. It was called a gobelin. G-O-B-E-L-I-N, a gobelin tapestry. And she found it and she cabled back to America. It was many years ago. And she said she had found this. $25,000 was the price. Will I buy? And Untermeyer wired back. He went to the telegram operator and he said, no, comma, price too high. And a few weeks later, his wife came back from Europe and she was full of excitement and she said, wait till you see the tapestry. And her husband was shocked that she had ignored his request. And he said, I told you not to buy it. And she pulled out the telegram and she said, no, look, what does it say? The telegram operator had missed out the comma, and it said, no price too high. No price too high. And that's what Jesus thinks when he poured out his ransom for his people. He was saying, no price too high. And this ransom succeeded. It was valuable and it was victorious. It did what it was intended to do. Every single one for whom this ransom was paid will be freed. And when Jesus poured out his soul unto death, the ransom was paid to his Father, who had pronounced the sentence on the sinners and had committed them into this punishment of being held captive by sin and Satan. And when Jesus paid the price, God reversed the sentence and ordered the captives to be freed. He there had the judicial basis to declare this heavenly and royal pardon for those who had sinned against heaven and against him. The precious blood of Christ. There were two soldiers who were once guarding the Rock of Gibraltar, two British soldiers. And one was a Christian, he was on one side of the tunnel, and the other was a seeker. And they were both on night duty, and the Christian was meditating on the precious blood of Christ. And at the other end of the tunnel was the seeker, who was, all he could think about was his doubts and his fears and his worries. And as the Christian was meditating on the precious blood of Christ, he was startled by the appearance of his commanding officer, who had noticed him distracted. And the officer demanded on the spot the password to the tunnel. And the Christian just blurted out the subject that was filling his mind, and he said, "The precious blood of Christ." And the commanding officer looked shocked, and when the soldier had recovered his composure, he said, "Oh, no, 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 sorry," and he came out with the right password. But the words he had spoken travelled along the tunnel, echoing off the walls, the rock as it went along, until it came at the end of the tunnel to the seeker, to the doubter, to the fearer. And these words came to his ears like the voice of an angel from heaven: "The precious blood of Christ." And all his doubts and all his fears disappeared. The precious blood of Christ. What a ransom. Do you need anything more than that? Notice what it says. A ransom for many. Doesn't say for all, but it does say for many. Many. Many males, many females, many rich, many poor, many sinners, many terrible sinners, many awful sinners, many of the very worst sinners. Can you not find some consolation in this little word? Many. It's not saying for a handful, for a few, but for many. Is there not some hope for you in that word? Can you not possibly find yourself in the many? Why exclude yourself? Because you're not worthy? None of the many are. Because you're not good enough? None of the many are. It's not merits that brought Christ into this world. It's misery. Our misery. David Livingstone was preaching the gospel to tribes in Africa, and he was asked by one of the hearers, "How can one man save many men? How can one life redeem many lives?" And he took out of his pocket two coins. One was the old copper penny, big and heavy. And the other was the tiny little gold sovereign, much smaller, much lighter than the copper penny. And he said to the hearers, this penny is actually worth far less than this sovereign. In fact, 240 pennies are required to make up this sovereign. Why? Because of the intrinsic value of the metals. Because the metal in the copper is worth far less than the metal in the sovereign. And so it is that this one precious golden life can redeem many copper, many alloy, many mixed up worthless sinners like you and I. You think, young ones here, maybe we don't know what's ahead of you. But you know, if you ever stop coming to church, I hope you never do. But if you do, I hope you'll never get away from our flag, the Union Jack. What are its colours? The gospel colours. Red, white, and blue. The red blood of Christ. The pardon that purifies and that brings to heaven. Red, white, and blue. Sacrifice, purity, and paradise. Please never forget that. Whenever you see that flag, remember the gospel. Here is the servant of all servants. You can't do him service until he does you service. You can't serve the Lord until he first serves you. He did not come to be served, but to give service. He didn't come to acquire treasure, but to bestow treasure. He didn't come to gain honour, but to give honour to many. To many. We think of the monk, the poor Roman Catholic monk, who all his life had been troubled by his guilty conscience that none of his church's teachings or rituals could absolve or heal. And he came to his dying moments, and people were bringing to him all the beads and all the holy waters and all the sacraments and all the rituals, and he said, away with them. And his last words were these. They were in Latin. Tua vulnera, O Jesu. Tua vulnera, O Jesu. Meaning what? Thy wounds, O Jesus. Thy wounds, O Jesus. And that's my hope. And I hope it's your hope. The wounds of Christ. The blood of Christ alone. Is that the flag that you are resting your life in and your eternity in? The blood-stained flag of Christ. There's a story told of the Boer War where British soldiers were suddenly attacked by a huge enemy force, and many casualties were taken. They retreated quickly, but the colonel saw that they were going to be blown off the face of the earth, and the wounded casualties in between the two forces were themselves in great danger. And so he got on his horse, and he realized he had no Red Cross flag. So he got back off, he found a pillow, and he realized he had no red paint. So what did he do? He cut himself, and he poured out his blood to make the sign of a cross on the white pillow. He rode out into the heat of the battle. He got to the wounded soldiers, and he raised the flag. And the Boers respected it, and went nowhere near those who were sheltering under this blood-stained cross. And that's your only hope too. The blood-stained cross of Christ. What more do you need? What more does God need? Nothing. This price is enough for him and for you. Let us pray.